All right, my name is Delana Turner. The date is February 25th, and I'm here with Sewanee alumni Renia Dotson. Yes.
Renee Dotson.
Mm-hmm. All right, so can you tell me a little bit about your first impressions of where you're from and your first impressions of Sewanee, how you got here?
Okay. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Monroeville, Alabama. I currently live in Greenville, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have first impressions of Sewanee because I only saw Sewanee the day I matriculated. That was the first time I had ever laid eyes on the campus or the domain. So imagine my surprise. I had only seen it in brochures. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't, it was well before the days of internet. And so therefore you couldn't browse it or look at any webcams or anything. You just looked at glossy pictures. And the glossy pictures looked, it was interesting. It looked different. It was big buildings, mm-hmm. made out of stone, and all glamorous. You know, it was a thing before Harry Potter was a thing. So I was looking forward to that. And I was scheduled to have a visit after being accepted, but I broke my ankle playing softball and I wasn't able to attend. But I still honored my commitment to come, and so the day that I moved in as a freshman was the first time that I had seen Sewanee. So it was beautiful. I thought it was beautiful. It was completely different from anything that I had seen or experienced in my small hometown of Monroeville, Alabama. But there were some things about it that was also familiar. It was not like anything I had seen before, but it wasn't because I hadn't traveled, because the summer before I had traveled throughout Europe, and so I had seen some cathedrals and stuff, and so some of this architecture was familiar, but still, I wasn't going there to live, I was coming to live here and be dropped off. So it was scary, it was exciting, it was different, and most of all, I was here, mm-hmm. and I just knew from then that I was going to be here for 4 years, and this was just going to be my new home, like it or not. I was here. Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah. Okay. And so I see that Dr. Henrietta Kroon,
yes,
was an influential faculty or staff member. Can you tell me more about her role?
Oh yes.
And did she have a role in biology for you?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
She was my faculty advisor.
Okay.
But she was much more than that. She was a mentor. She was a friend. We're still friends. We keep in touch. She was a beloved mentor. Mm-hmm. Everybody said that. She was fair. She was hard. As I've said before, she definitely provided a hard place from which to launch, mm-hmm. but then she also provided me a soft place to land. Mm-hmm. It was somewhere I could go and talk about my fears and my aspirations, and there she was, someone to tell me to pick myself up and when I needed to, and dust myself off and keep going, and yes, you're good enough, and yes, you are deserving. And she was also there to tell me, you can do better than this. Mm-hmm. Get up, do better. I'm not putting up with this. Like I said, a hard place from which to launch, but also a soft place to land. And I think that made all of the difference for mm-hmm. me here, in that just knowing I had that one person. And the beauty of it is, she didn't look like me, but and her influence was just more than words, mm-hmm. More than pep talks. It was, she modeled the behavior. She modeled the behavior of a professional woman, mm-hmm. and you have to, when you find yourself in a mentor role, you have to realize that it's not just the professional part that you're mentoring. She was also a wife and mother and married to another professional man. So that concept of yes, you can have it all was kind of established, because we you know, there's a saying that we can be what we see. Mm-hmm. So that piece was there. But then also the corollary was that, yes, I saw that in a woman. I could be what I see as a woman. I still didn't, you know, have any African-American female role models. But at that point, I didn't find that as a loss, because she filled so many other slots there.
Yeah.
But it was great. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I count that as my all-time. Mm-hmm. I think that's the glue that held me together when I was here. She was.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you say she didn't look like you, can you talk a little bit more about her background?
Oh, she was, a PhD in biology from the University of North Carolina.
Okay.
And she grew up in North Carolina, but she's a Caucasian woman.
Okay.
That's what I mean by she didn't look like me. But the only reason I put that in there is because I think it's important to realize that to be effective and to succeed here, the person doesn't necessarily have to share the same race or look like you. It's just it's the relationship that you make. And so, and then that was the purpose for saying that,
yeah.
Not that race played anything with it.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to reiterate that, because when I came here, there were only like 13 black students across all years. And so, you know, finding someone that looked like me were the criteria, then I would have been lost.
Right,
so.
Right.
So, no. But that's why I say that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. And can you tell me a little bit more about your activities, like the University Choir, Proctor, Order of the Gownsmen? How did they kind of like shape your experience here at Sewanee?
Yep. That was wonderful.
And, like, yeah, how involved were you? Just tell me all about it.
Choir is extensively involved. I mean, we sang every Sunday, so I went to, then we had choir, choir rehearsals during the week, I think several times during the week. And the choir was, I had my choir friends, so I had a choir family, a place where I belonged, and I was accepted. And it was a great way for me to get to know and experience the Episcopal religion. And so, because it's an Episcopal school, and therefore that was part of the identity, so I learned it from within, and that was good. But the choir provided opportunities in and of itself. We did, we would have domestic choir tours every year, kind of in the break between the Advent semester and the fall semester. So in that January, we do Evensong in Episcopal churches throughout the United States. And we take a geographic component. Like one year we did the Northeast, the next year we did the South. We didn't ever do the West, but so we did two of those. And we would be hosted by Episcopal families, and so it was wonderful. And of course, the singing was good, but the bus rides what made it be, because you spent time with your choir colleagues, and it was just a wonderful bonding experience. And of course, we'd come back together and talk about our housing experiences.
Yeah.
So, guest you were,
yeah.
Today. But the jewel in the crown of the choir is that my junior year, we went to England. We did choir tour in England, so we flew from here to England, and we did Evensong in all these beautiful English cathedrals, and that was an experience that I would not have gained any other place. So that choir was a very big part of my life, because it took a significant amount of time, but totally worth it. Would definitely do it again.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That was awesome. I was a member of the Black Student Union. I used to plan all of our parties, go shopping for them. We'd buy those little boxed wine, the Franzia.
Yeah, yes.
With the spigot.
Yep. We still use them.
So and that cheese ball. So and the crackers and stuff, but we'd do the food for that, and we had our own little Black Student Union formal, and so yeah, mm-hmm. I was a party planner then. So that, I think that was some of my earliest party planning, and it gave me experience for planning events there. I was a member of Theta Pi Sorority. I was actually, I think I probably was the first black person to be in Theta Pi, because it was in 1985.
Right.
There may have been someone before me, but I don't think so. Mm-hmm. And that was a whole other set of friends and a set of belonging there. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a worthwhile experience. And then I served on lots of search committees and different other kind of committees, giving input for things for the university. It didn't take much to be asked if you were visible. And then I was an assistant proctor my sophomore year, and because I really, really loved and bonded with my assistant proctor when I was a freshman. So then I was an AP the second year, and then a proctor for 2 years after that. And that was, you know, that gave me experience with leadership roles, leading, and your first understanding that, you know, leading is not always happy times, that there were times where you had to enforce the rules and you had to be the heavy. And it was just, how are leaders born? You are given opportunities to lead. And so that was a great opportunity there for me to do that. And I was very grateful for that.
Yeah.
It opened doors. And of course, in all of these roles, you're considered leaders. So you sit with regents, you sit with other visitors or whoever, if consultants are coming to the community or whatever. You get to sit with those people. But then there are, you know, that is when you get a chance to learn, meet, and it's all part of shaping us into who we are. So
yeah,
that was all good. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure I didn't put them all down, but my memory fails me. But those are the highlights.
Yeah. And this is like a little small question. What halls were you a proctor in?
I was a proctor at Hunter and at Gorgas.
Oh, okay.
I was a freshman at Gorgas.
Oh.
And then I went back to Gorgas as a senior. And you're like, why would you go back to Gorgas as a senior proctor? Well, there's a little story behind that. Nobody, of course, wanted to be at Gorgas because it was so far out.
Yeah.
And you knew. And I knew that I was... we were up for proctorship, and you knew that someone was going to draw that short straw. And I'm like, there's a good probability that I could have, you know, I could draw this. There's a good possibility that Dean Cushman is going to say, she was the dean at the time, is going to say, well, tough luck, you're going to Gorgas, I need somebody at Gorgas. And I was like, so there's a good chance you could lose that argument. You could always be kind of play the card that why would you know? You could always be just devious and play the race card and say, why would you send the only black woman out there? I was like, no, I'm not going to do that. So like, how can we make this equitable? How can I make something out of this and still be seen as helpful? So I went to I found several of my friends, three of my best friends, and I said, hey, if I could get you a single, would you go to Gorgas with me? And they were like, one was like, no, I want to be in the center campus. The other two was like, you can get me a single. I was like, I can try. And they're like, yes. So I went into the dean's office, and dean of women then, and I said, you need proctors to go to Gorgas. And she said, yes. And I said, what if I were to go to volunteer to go to Gorgas for you, would you allow two of my friends to have singles there? She said, name it. Who are they? And so I told her who my friends were. They got singles, and I ended up being a proctor. And so I made it work for all of us. She got something, I got something, my friends got something. So,
right.
So we were a happy little lot.
Mm-hmm. And when you traveled with the university choir to England, was that your first time traveling?
No.
Okay.
No. It was the second time that I had been abroad. I went abroad to Europe when I was 17.
Mm-hmm.
And ironically, then I was a member of what they call American Musical Ambassadors Band. It was a group of 100 high school students that they got together from across the nation. You had to do an audition, and then you were selected for a band, and they brought us together in New York for rehearsals, and then we went out to Europe. So I spent 3 weeks in Europe, 21 days touring Europe. So that was not my first time.
Okay.
But this tour was specifically to England. So it was my second time to London when we were there. But still, it was different because, I mean, it was you still was touring with a group, but this is a group I had spent 3 to 4 years with, not ones that I had just met like 2 or 3 weeks before.
Yeah.
And so, and I thought, of course, I was older and wiser.
Yes. And can you talk a little bit more? Okay, I'm going to ask a little bit more about some of the BSU initiatives that were going on at the time. Like, I know you said you were a party planner.
Yeah, well, I think I did our social stuff, and there is a group of men in the, within the BSU who were always raising issues about equity, equality, that sort of thing. And so if it were a topic that I could align with, I did my part. I just, the BSU was not the central part of what I did in campus, but it was very integral in what I did. So I was always front and center with our initiatives and trying to make things happen.
Yeah. And about how many people were part of BSU? Because I know you said maybe 13 people across 4 years.
13 across 4 years when I was here, but then it grew. We may have gotten into the 20s probably. But most people at some point intersected with that.
Okay.
That was probably the home. It was probably like the home base, so to speak, but we didn't have a physical space that was our home base. There was no multicultural center when I was here. So we met, you know, in like, I think St. Luke's had a meeting area because we found meeting spaces, but we didn't have a space of our own. However, the community built in that was not dependent upon a physical space, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And being one of the first, if not the first, Theta Pi, how big was Theta Pi in your time here? Like, how integral was that?
Oh, it was big. It was a very big sorority and one of the more active and, of course, I like to think influential sororities here. It was a big thing. I remember getting the bid, and I was like, oh, okay, we were opening them up, and, you know, I just did the rush thing just because I immersed myself in everything that Sewanee had to offer. I was not going to segregate myself in any way, and it's like, I'm here now. I might as well see what happens. So I did rush, and there were several girls who encouraged me to do rush who were in Theta Pi, and I'm clearly oblivious to what's happening, which probably made my rushing a lot more authentic because I didn't go into it with, oh my God, I have to get this certain bid, and if I don't get this certain bid, then life will be over for me, because it was not like that. It's like, oh, I think I'll see what this is all about, and I'll see if I like any of these girls or whatever. And of course, I liked every group I went to. It's like, but I did it with no anxiety, no angst, because it wasn't critical or even crucial. It was wonderful that I did match, but it was not crucial but critical to who I was at the time. And so I got the Theta Pi bid. I didn't shake on the first day. I had to think it over. And there were people looking at me like, have you lost your mind? You got a Theta Pi bid. I'm like, oh, is this good? And then finally I talked to the members, and then I thought, yes, I should do this. I should do this. And I think that, you know, we always, as African-American women, particularly when you're a first, you always carry the burden of the first in that, even if sometimes I think we get pushed into accepting positions or doing things because we feel the burden of being the first. And we carry the then, whether real or just assumed by us, we carry the burden of the race as being the first. And you may not totally feel like it, but you feel like you should do it for the race. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think there was definite to say that was not a part of the decision would be very disingenuous, because that was very much a part of the, because I felt like I owed it to the other black women who were not offered a bed to open that door. To open that door. So, and, but I think that's also an unfair burden sometimes that we place on ourselves, that, you know, but the bid, accepting the bid, seemed so much more symbolic at the time. And I do think that it was necessary. It was helpful. I think it was helpful. Of course, I have to believe that, but yeah. I don't have to believe it. I could accept it if it were not, but I do think it, I do believe it to be true. And so, but you know, there is the burden of being the first, but at Sewanee, most things were the first.
Yeah.
Most spaces I entered, I was the first or the only.
Yeah. And with you bearing that burden of being like the first and only, can you talk about times where you felt out of place? Because it seemed like you used these organizations and like you definitely forged a path for yourself, but like were there any times where you were like, I can't do this, or maybe this is not right for me, or even times where you, and this is going all the way down, but you know, like considered leaving Sewanee because you,
I never considered leaving Sewanee, okay. But I did leave some organizations. That by the end of my, by the time I was in my senior year, I was, the sorority scene was good, but it was not everything that I needed to do. Somewhere between junior year, I think that penultimate year always has you thinking, forward thinking about what's going to come next, is that I learned I somewhat put down the burden of the race on my back and doing things just because it is the first, it's opening this door. I feel like I need to do this to be representative of all black people. And I started thinking about the needs of me, my needs, my personal needs, and what things spoke to me. And I started being intentional about my time and the people to whom I gave my time and the situations in which I imparted my energy. And so, if it were something that spoke to something that I believed in, then it was okay to be the first and do that, or being the first didn't really matter anymore. It was where I chose to put my time.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the growth for me, to not just, because I had initially just immersed myself in everything and in my mind had taken on the whole, you know, representation of entire race and all things, all matters. And that creates a sense of, it creates a milieu, an environment for perfectionism to thrive.
Mm-hmm.
And with that comes anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I was, I would not have, describe myself as an anxious person or suffering from anxiety, but did I feel a pressure to perform and exceed? Oh yes, I mm-hmm. did, I did. And so by being intentional about where I put my energy, that helped out a lot, but it also served me well for later in life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you do the things that bring you joy and that will uplift you as well, but keep you true to yourself. You don't have to carry the whole race on the world. We're not that guy with the sculptor that has the world on his back.
Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Atlas.
Yes.
Yeah, we're not Atlas. You know, we're not superwomen. We just need to learn to live and lead intentionally. And so that's what I tried to impart to my daughter, who learned from some of my mistakes, but we'll see, but that was the growth. That was the growth line over Sewanee.
Yeah.
While I was here.
Thank you for that. Can you talk more about, because I know you said things that have helped in life after Sewanee, so I just wanted to kind of touch on what did life look like for you after Sewanee, and how did Sewanee kind of help in your career?
Well, life after Sewanee was straight into medical school for 4 years and then into general surgery residency for 5 years. So it was just kind of a narrow pace, but Sewanee has, you know, has grueling academics, and so you learn to work hard, you learn to study hard, And I think that the way we learned here was, it was conceptual learning as opposed to memorization, and just rote memorization and learning what we always had done. In medical school, that served me well, because sometimes when you're on a test and you're relying totally on your memory, anxiety will overtake you and you'll forget it. You know it, you learned it. There's a difference between memorizing it and learning it. And so what I mean by conceptual learning is I would study in such a way in medical school so that if I forgot the answer, I could figure it out. So I taught myself context clues. Like, for example, in histology, you know that an artery comes next to a vein, and there's like a lymphatic thing that comes next to it, lymphatic drainage that comes next to it. I taught myself those connections so that if it didn't look like what I had memorized, I still could look for certain things within that to tell me where I was. So I taught myself road signs to conceptualize learning. And that was a product of Swanee, because we always had essay tests. We didn't have, but then we couldn't take multiple choice tests because we didn't have much practice with that. But we had all essay tests, but it taught you conceptualized learning. And so I learned here how to act and do when I didn't know what to do. I learned to lean on my own understanding and to deduce my way out of situations, or better yet, to deduce my way into answers, to solutions. And so I think that served me very well. And Sewanee gave me the foundation, and the tools to do that. And for that, I am very grateful. And that has served me well throughout. Because when you don't know what to do, you at least have tools to help you figure out what to do. You don't always have to know the answers. Mm-hmm. But it's nice to be able to know that you can figure them out.
Yeah.
And I think that's what someone gave me. And being one of very few was constant practice for being in situations where you were one of very few. Because in surgery, only like 3% of surgeons or less than 4% are African-American women. So it's a tiny fraction. And I'm often don't see other people like me, often don't see other women in the room like me, but I lived in an environment for 4 years where I often didn't see other people like me, so it didn't, I didn't foster that, you know, any insecurities. Do I have insecurities? Yes. Do I often sometimes feel like, does imposter syndrome creep in a little bit? Yes, it does, but you know, we learn to banish it as long as we're... I mean, I had plenty of practice with that, but I can't ever sit... Yes, there were probably individual situations where I felt like I didn't belong, but I never had that overwhelming sense. I found that when I reached out to certain... when I reached out in different organizations, they in turn reached back out to me. If I opened my arms, they would embrace me. And so so I can't ever say that an overall arch that I didn't feel like I didn't belong here. But were there places where I couldn't go? Yes. Mm-hmm. Were there doors that were closed that I didn't have the strength to try to kick down, or I didn't feel it was necessary to kick down? Yeah. There were bastions of whiteness that were reserved for just, you know, majority people. There were. And did I feel left out of those? I knew that I didn't have access, but I don't think the access felt that important to me at the time.
Can you give an example of one?
You know, like they have certain ribbon societies.
Mm-hmm.
That when I was here, I noticed there are certain people now saying that they were members of those ribbon societies, but they were not accessible to us when we were here.
Mm-hmm.
It was more the ribbon societies and that sort of stuff. And so I knew there were doors that didn't open for me or would not open for me, but I didn't need to kick them down. They didn't serve any need for me, and so I didn't go looking for trouble for them, and to feel left out, I didn't.
Thank you. Can you talk a little bit about being a Wilkins Scholar?
It was a great honor, but also with that comes a responsibility because you got to keep your grades up. Mm-hmm. But it was nice to say I was a Wilkins Scholar. Mm-hmm. I won't lie about that. I enjoyed that title because it was an exclusive club at that point.
Okay.
Wilkins, I think the merit scholarships have changed since then, but Wilkins was the highest honor. So that immediately stratified you into a group of students and into a lofty circle. So yes, I enjoyed that group immensely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not gonna say I didn't.
Yeah. So that was, if I'm understanding correctly, a merit scholarship here at Sewanee.
Yes, it was.
Okay.
It was the highest honor.
The highest, okay.
I mean, we were a group. The Wilkins Scholars were a group.
So. Yeah. About how many do you remember? I'm sorry if I'm asking, like...
I can't remember that number. But there were only so many given per year.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you had, I think, maybe 4 or 5 per year were given.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
And so you were in, like, 2025.
Yeah.
But yeah, we had banquets and that kind of stuff. But, you know, we were distinguished. Mm-hmm. We were distinguished scholars. So, yes, that was a lofty place to be. Of course, did it carry with it the desire to, you know, well, not the desire, but just the need to perform, yeah. You know, so, yeah.
And this will be kind of one of the last questions. So your work and occupational experience is a colon and rectal surgeon, retired, mm-hmm. and healthcare consultant.
Mm-hmm.
So can you just, I know you kind of touched on it a little bit, but just talk a little bit more about how your experiences here, because I remember you said you went to medical school, but then you didn't get to like the surgery part of it and like being a healthcare consultant. So how did Sewanee?
So Sewanee, I went after I finished medical school, then I did residency and then my fellowship, and I went into private practice after that for 20 plus years. And so, but Sewanee created a love for lifelong learning and a desire for lifelong learning. But to step back from that, being in surgery lounges, they're predominantly male, they're predominantly white male, and they're predominantly older white male. So it was always good to be in a lounge and they start talking about their pedigrees where they went to school. And, you know, I'm practicing mainly in the South. And I would say that I graduated from Sewanee and the room shifts, because you can't argue with Sewanee, you just can't. So it gave me a, you know, I had a little bit more swagger up my wattage a little bit, because then they can't argue that, you know, just particularly the Southern gentleman. Okay, you can be a Southern gentleman, but because I remember being in the room with this pathologist and another surgeon, a urologist, I think, in Monroe, Louisiana, and they were talking about, you know, and they were trying to, they were ignoring me, and I was just like, oh, I'm going to watch this play out. So then they got to talking about, oh, well, I'm a Millsaps man and all this stuff. And I said, when I was leaving the room, I said, well, you know, gentlemen, you may be Millsaps men, but I am a Sewanee woman. And they're like, oh. You know, the sputtering starts coming. And I love dropping that bomb, that little truth nugget. So that's the one. Drop that bomb, mic drop, leave. So those are kind of things. So Sewanee's given me that. Mm-hmm. But in the South, the Sewanee education meant a lot. It carried a lot. It said a lot. It instantly, just like the Wilkins Scholar, elevated me on campus.
Mm-hmm.
Being a Sewanee grad, and being a black woman and a Sewanee grad in my age category, yeah, elevated me every time. And so that was fun. That was kind of fun to do that. Now, Sewanee does create in you for me, a need for a desire for lifelong learning. And so when I turned 50, I went, I knew that surgery was changing. There would have to be a change in the way I practice surgery, either to what we call minimally invasive surgery, surgery with robots and doing it laparoscopically. So I could retrain that way, or I could train differently. And so I decided to get a master's of public health so that I could work with healthcare, leadership, disparities, policy making. That was good. Because as a surgeon, you can only operate on one person at a time. So you can help one person at a time. But as a public policy maker and shaker, you can help thousands, millions at a time. So that was attractive in doing that. And it also provided a second act of service. The first act being medicine itself, but it's also a second act. There's something you said for the second act. And there are great men like Winston Churchill and Abraham Lincoln who both had the second act was much better than the first. So I started thinking about the second act. What would my second act be like? And so public health was the avenue in which I was going to channel that energy into. And toward the end of my public health degree, we were learning about financials for a corporation, and the program directors or whoever's over project director, you have to be responsible, or CEO, you're responsible for what the CFO does. You're responsible for their financial accounts. And so I was like, how would I recognize a nefarious CFO? How would I recognize that? Would I recognize that? And so could I forensically track them? So I went back and got an MBA so that I could know the need for, I would have even say that someone created a need for lifelong learning. So I'm using all of that knowledge now to be able to unravel and make effective change in this thing that we call healthcare. Yeah. And actually, more importantly, the public's health than the population's health. Mm-hmm. So that's
amazing.
That's the Sewanee way.
Yep. And just as a last question, before we wrap up, what's one piece of advice that you would give? And I don't know if I want. I don't think I'm going to restrict it to like a black student or a black woman here at Sewanee. But what's one piece of advice you would give? And can you define who it would be like addressed to? You know what I mean?
I would address it to all women. I wouldn't stratify my. I think my advice. I could give more specific advice to varying demographics. Mm-hmm. But I think the advice holds for everyone, mm-hmm. and that's you can to be intentional about your time, mm-hmm. Intentional about your thoughts, intentional about your actions, and make sure that the space you feel is one that fulfills you. If it doesn't feel right, then don't do it. If it, you know, doesn't sound right, don't say it. You know, if it doesn't look right, don't wear it. And I don't mean a garment. Mm-hmm. I mean, if being within an organization or doing an activity does not look right on you as who you want to be and what you want to project, don't wear it. Mm-hmm. Don't wear that organization's cloak. You know, and I think in order to do that in the course of being intentional about what you do, who you associate with, who you allow to affect your brand, and your brand is many things. It's who you are, how you carry yourself, who you want to be, where you're going. Just be very intentional about that. And the biggest jewel I would say to you right now is to start practicing self-care now, mm-hmm. so that when it becomes very crucial in midlife, now when it's crucial, that it's a habit. It's not something you have to learn. It becomes a habit. It's as natural to you as brushing your teeth. You know, that you learn self-care now. And learn, it's more than just the physical act of like doing your hair, but learn, you know, when you need rest, what kind of rest you need, learn what affirmations speak to you and work for you and say them over and over and over to yourselves. Learn when to disengage. Learn when to engage. Know what people you need to disengage from yourself. Learn what energy fields or people that people give off that are good for you. Which ones are nurturing and which ones don't mean you harm. And start practicing that self-care now. And self-care is, for me, is emotional, spiritual, mental, and physical. So it's all about being whole. But start a routine now so that it becomes commonplace for you. That it's more uncommon for you not to practice self-care than it is for you to do it. It should not. And I will say this specifically for Black women. We've been accustomed, and it's in our DNA, it's kind of epigenetic for us to work ourselves into the ground. And I think that we need to start exhibiting and modeling the behavior for our daughters and granddaughters so that we change we alter our DNA in a good way, such that self-care becomes important, because in practicing self-care, we show others how to care for us and how to treat us.
So. You did say you like dropping little truth nuggets. You did say that. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to end the interview.